She grabbed Laura's right breast and pinched the nipple, making Laura cry out. "Where is it?"
"It's the backpacks. We left them behind, in the police station in Brava."
The woman stared at her.
"I don't believe you."
She pressed the tip of the blade against Laura's throat.
"You sold it, didn't you? Just tell me, and then this will all be over."
I don't know what you're talking about."
"Liar!"
The woman screeched in her face, spittle flying and spraying Laura's forehead.
"I'm going to kill you if you don't tell me the truth."
"We left them in Brava, I swear. I don't understand what... What are you looking for?"
The woman stared into her face, into her eyes, for several seconds, and then stepped back and, to Laura's astonishment, began to laugh hysterically. She doubled over, barely able to breathe. She looked up at Laura and, catching her breath, said,
"You're telling the truth."
"I swear, I promise."
As suddenly as it had appeared, the woman's smile vanished.
"After all this, you left it in Romania, and you don't even know what I'm talking about, do you? My God!"
She muttered something to herself in another language. Then she said,
"Okay, I'm going to wait till he gets here, and you can tell him yourself. He can decide what to do with you. I've had it with all of this shit."
Bang, bang, bang. The blonde turned towards the sound.
"That must be him, at last. Why doesn't the stupid asshole just let himself in?"
She left the room. Laura heard the back door opening, then a woman's cry and a thump. The man stepped into the room, and later Laura would be amazed that she hadn't wet herself at that moment. It was him, the devil.
"Hello, Laura," the old man said.
He held an iron bar in his hand. He stared at her naked breasts for a long moment, licking his lips, then pulled her sweater back down, covering her.
"The key,"
he whispered, leaving the room and coming back a minute later to unlock the handcuffs.
"Come with me," he said. "I'll take you home."
He grabbed hold of her wrist and pulled her up. He put an arm around her shoulders and walked her towards the door. She felt dizzy, sick, barely able to stand upright. She stared at her feet, trying not to fall. As they reached the threshold of the room, she heard a soft thump, like someone dropping a heavy bag, and a voice that she had heard before said, "Camelia?" The old man sighed, took his arm away from Laura's shoulders, and stooped to pick up the iron bar again.
"Wait here," he said.
Chapter 41. I paced the flat, watching the sky grow dark outside, puzzling over everything Edward and I had been talking about. Claudia Savage had told me that in order to recover from my PTSD, I needed to be able to confront what had happened to me, to slowly peel back the protective layers I had built in my mind and deal with the reality of the events that had frightened me so much. But that hadn't happened. Instead, those layers had been ripped away, burned as if they'd been struck by the Molotov cocktail chucked into Edward's office. And now I felt like that guy in A Clockwork Orange, strapped down, eyes clamped open, forced to stare at the most horrific scenes, the evidence of humanity's darkest heart. With no warning, the horror would flash into my real life, replacing it whole. When I looked at the framed photographs on the wall, I saw the Polaroids pinned up in that house. Walking into my bedroom, I found an emaciated woman with black spaces instead of teeth manacled to my bed, grinning at me. A neighbor's baby cried out, and I imagined it locked in that tiny coffin, beating against the lid. I prowled into the kitchen, desperate for a drink, but I had poured all the alcohol down the sink. I clawed at my own face, sucked in deep breaths, tried desperately to calm myself. If I concentrated on the puzzle, maybe that would work. Camelia, what did she want? I grabbed a fresh piece of paper and tried to summarize what we knew, or at least what we thought we knew so far. Camelia and her partner had keys to my flat. They must have obtained these in Romania, which meant they had to be the thieves from the train. They had broken into my flat, searched it, taken my laptop and brought it back again. I presumed they must have looked through it, but why return it? I had searched it for viruses and spyware when I got it back, and it was clean. Then they had come back again with the dog. Finally, on two occasions, Camellia tried to seduce me, succeeding the second time, but stopping when I was unable to give her the information she wanted. What was that information? Something illegal. I closed my eyes and went back to that night in the train carriage. The thief, Camellia, had taken our passports, our money, tickets and keys. There were other valuables in our bags, like the camera. Why didn't they take that? My phone had been sitting on my chest and would have been easy to take, but they had left it. Why? Because the answer was almost there. I forced myself to concentrate. Why take only the items that would most inconvenience us, forcing us to cut short our trip around Europe? The loss of our passports meant we had to fly home. Was that their intention? To get us to come back here? To leave Eastern Europe? It almost felt like a prank, an act of mischief, something the thieves barely benefited from. I sat up. Did that mean the theft wasn't the point? My mind flashed back to the CCTV video. The male intruder searching drawers and cupboards. The woman holding the dog on its leash. Did they really bring the dog so it would attack me? Why the roundabout method, when they could just wait for their chance out in the world to get me? Why the dog? I pictured it now on the slightly grainy video clip, straining at the leash, sniffing around. Fuck! I shouted. Sniffing around. I had it. The wait for Edward to return was agonizing. Finally, I heard his car pull up outside, and a moment later he pressed the buzzer to be let in. I had been over and over my logic in my head, and was sure I was correct. I knew what Camellia was after. I knew what this was all about. Drugs. It was the only thing that made sense. Camellia and her partner, whoever that was, had planted drugs in my and Laura's backpacks. Then they took our passports, knowing this would mean we'd have to go home. Two middle-class English people. Respectable-looking, normal, not acting shiftily because we were oblivious to what we were carrying. The perfect drug mules. The plan must have been to intercept us once we were back in London, to retrieve the drugs before we found them. They couldn't have known that we would be thrown off the train, or that we would leave our backpacks in a police station in Romania. I laughed when I thought about this. I would love to have seen their faces when they found this out. Then I thought about what would have happened if Laura and I hadn't left the backpacks behind, if we'd been caught at customs trying to bring illegal drugs into the country. And my laughter died. I went through it again. They had broken in, searched my flat, then come back with a dog to see if it could sniff out the drugs. I guessed they had left it here when it failed to find anything, probably in a fit of temper, wanting to punish me. Then Camellia had come back for another try, clearly believing that I must have sold the drugs. That was the illegal act she wanted me to admit to. In my moment of triumph, having figured out the mystery, I didn't stop to think about the rest of it, how this connected to all the other strange and horrible stuff that had been going on, like, what did they hope to achieve by firebombing Edward's office? Had they killed Jake? If so, why on earth had they? Why attempt to push Laura under a tube rather than try to get information out of her? If I'd thought about it in any depth, I would have realized this violence just didn't fit. If I was a vicious drug dealer, I wouldn't pussyfoot around. I would have waited here for me, grabbed me, and tortured the information out of me. But, sure, I'd solved the puzzle. I didn't wonder about that. The main question that bugged me was why they had waited so long to try to retrieve the drugs. It had been 3 months. What was the explanation for that? Edward came into the flat, and before I could open my mouth to tell him about my eureka moment, he said, "You'll never guess what I just saw." He ushered me into the living room, as if this was his own flat, and threw himself down on the sofa. I remained standing. "So, I went to the address you gave me where Laura's staying. When I parked, I could see a woman standing by the gate. It was her." He pointed at the picture of Laura on the wall. Edward went on. "I was about to get out of the car, call to her, but she went into the garden. She was acting... well, I don't know her, don't know what she's normally like, but she was acting weird. Like she was in shock or something, as if she hardly knew where she was.
I went up and looked through the gate. It was odd. I could hear a woman's voice coming from somewhere in the garden, but I couldn't see anyone. I didn't want to scare her, because then I thought she'd never talk to me, but I wanted to see what she was doing. Was she talking to someone? I could only hear one voice. The voice sounded frightened, almost on the verge of hysteria.
"That's what she's been like recently," I said.
He nodded. Anyway, I opened the gate as quietly as I could and went into the garden. I could see Laura clearly now. She was gesticulating, miming what looked like one person striking another, and then I realized she was talking to someone else. He paused dramatically, then said, "Describe Alina to me."
Alina? She was quite tall, skinny, pale skin, black hair with red streaks in it. She wore a black leather jacket and black jeans. Quite attractive, if you're into that sort of thing.
Why do you want to know that now?
Because I just saw Laura talking to her.
What?
But,
Daniel, unless I've developed the ability to see ghosts too, Alina is very much alive.
Part 5. Romania, August to November 2013. Chapter 42. Alina stopped as she stepped between the trees and looked up at the dark canopy of the forest, black branches knitted together against the sky, the faintest watery trace of moonlight seeping through. She was a city girl. She wouldn't hesitate to walk through a dark underpass to cross one of Sibiu's roughest housing estates. Give her the darkest spaces of the city any day over this creepy, silent place. Still, she was desperate for a piss, and there was no way she was going to squat in front of the English couple, even if they promised to look away. She would find a spot here, close to the edge of the forest, not too far in, and then they could be on their way, so she could try to salvage this plan, make sure it worked, despite what had happened. The plan had been Eon's idea. Eon. She still couldn't decide if she really liked him or not. He was good-looking, confident, and capable in bed, with no hang-ups, unlike some of the more sensitive writer and artist types she'd been with. When Eon had told Daniel that he was writing a book, she'd had to work hard to keep her face straight. Eon had borrowed that line straight from Alina's ex, a guy whom Eon mocked on a regular basis. All that stuff about collaborating on a graphic novel was bullshit too. Eon had no interest in her artwork, though he liked it when she drew naked women, would urge her to give them bigger breasts, curvier butts. He was an idiot, really. He wasn't even that tough, even though he talked the talk. He was a schemer and a dreamer. He wasn't a violent thug. She wouldn't have been with him if he was. Anyway, once this was all over, when she had her cut of the money, she had decided she was going to leave him. She would use the money to buy herself enough time to finish her graphic novel. It was called Mirella, and was the story of a girl who walks the earth after she is murdered by a cabal of serial killers seeking revenge. Mirella finds everyone who is connected to her suffering and kills them in a variety of imaginative ways. Alina had already been working on it for 2 years, spending every spare minute, when she wasn't at her shitty waitressing job, immersed in this tale of blood and redemption. She didn't think Eon would care too much when she left him. He would have his money, and Alina knew he had a thing for Camellia, who had moved to London last year, dreaming of making her fortune. The last Alina heard, Camellia was working as a fucking stripper or something. It suited her. Camellia had been showing everything to the boys at school in exchange for cash since she was 14. She traded on her beauty. A slutty, obvious kind of beauty, and Alina was pretty sure the girl would either end up married to a millionaire or murdered in an alley. Her fate lay in the hands of men. Alina was different. She was going to make her own way, succeed or fail because of her own talents and luck. She accepted that sometimes other people would get hurt along the way. She felt guilty about wrecking the English couple's holiday, for example, but not too guilty. They already had money, they were privileged, without realizing it, soft and gullible. What was the worst that could happen to them? As Eon had pointed out, people like that, wholesome, middle-class English people, didn't get pulled aside at airports. With their passports stolen, their grand tour would be cut short. Oh, how her heart bled. They would go home, get married, start having babies, and they would soon forget all about their truncated trip. Best of all, they would never know what they had carried through customs. They would live on in blissful ignorance, while Eon, Alina, and, unfortunately, Camellia, experienced for the first time how it felt to have money. It had all started with a stroke of luck. Eon knew a guy called Chris, who had ripped off a drug dealer in Sibiu and had given the cocaine to Eon for safekeeping, while Chris tried to convince the drug dealer that he was innocent. Eon, who dreamed of being a gangster but was too soft to do anything about it, had gone along with it, thinking it would impress his friends. With grim inevitability, the dealer and his gang had tortured and killed Chris. Eon, fearing he would be next, had suggested to Alina that they go away for a while. He sold it to her as a romantic adventure. Then came the good fortune. They got as far as Hungary when Eon heard that the dealers had been arrested and charged with Chris's murder. They would be in prison for a long time. At which point, Eon revealed to Alina that he had half a kilo of pure cocaine in his suitcase. She was furious. He had smuggled the drugs across the Hungarian border. Was he so stupid that he didn't know what happened to people caught with such a large quantity of drugs? Life in jail, for both of them. But Eon had a plan, which he laid out to her over the next hour. It involved Camellia, which immediately put Alina's back up. But Eon had already spoken to the little slut, and she'd assured him that she knew someone through her pole-dancing club who would be interested in buying the drugs. "I can't sell them back home," he said. "It's much too risky. If the gang who originally owned the drugs found out, I'd be dead." So they needed to get the coke to London. Alina stared at him. Carrying the drugs into Hungary was stupid enough, but taking it through an airport or on a boat into the UK, that was insane. They argued for a while about Eurostar and how risky it actually was when Eon let slip that he would surely get searched at customs because of his previous conviction for possession, which Alina hadn't known about. "But you could do it," he said, "if you love me."
"Who said I love you?"
she asked.
"I'm not doing it. I'm not risking going to jail."
They fought some more until eventually Eon said,
"Then we'll have to find someone to take it for us."
Before that, they decided to head back into Romania, to Sibiu. They would have to cross the border again, but on the train here the guards had been half asleep. If they took the night train back, the guards would probably be comatose. They spotted the English couple at Budapest station. They didn't look like typical backpackers. They had a more well-to-do air about them. They looked cleaner, and the guy was carrying an expensive camera. Eon nudged Alina and whispered his plan to her. It was a crazy scheme.
"Why?" Alina asked. "Don't we go to the airport and find an English couple there?"
Eon shook his head.
"What opportunity do you think we'll get at an airport to put the drugs into somebody's bag? This is perfect."
Yet again they argued, until Eon eventually sighed and said,
"Okay, let's see how it plays out."
She agreed, almost certain that nothing would happen, that they would end up back home with the drugs. Except the opportunity did arise. Eon chatted them up, spinning a lie about how they were going to see her parents, who were actually both dead. Alina felt awkward and withdrawn at first, intimidated by this wealthy English couple, until she realized that she had no reason to feel like that, and she had decided to play along, to be friendly. She actually quite liked them, especially Laura, who was sweet and far less pretentious or stuck-up than Alina expected. She felt genuine sympathy for Laura when that creep stared at her. Daniel was okay too, even if he was typically eager to talk about himself. But she still didn't think they'd get the opportunity to put the cocaine into the couple's backpacks, unless one of them could lure the English couple to the buffet car, or hope they both went to the toilet at the same time, leaving their bags in their new friend's care. Then Eon spotted the empty sleeper compartment and persuaded them to go for a nap, promising to keep an eye out for guards. After they went, Eon and Alina sat in tense silence for a while, before Eon said, "Wait here," and carried his own bag out of their carriage. When he came back 5 minutes later, he was sweating.
"Where?" she whispered. "I did it," he whispered back. "They were sleeping like babies. 250 grams in each backpack. They each had a small bag of dirty laundry at the bottom of their packs. I put them in those."
"In dirty laundry?"
Yeah, well, I figured they're not going to stop to wash their underwear on the way home. I took their passports, tickets, and bank cards, too. I got some keys, too, in case Camellia needs them. And the girl's phone, a nice Samsung. Daniel just has a crappy, scratched-up iPhone 5 with a cracked screen, so I didn't bother. Why don't people take care of their gadgets?
Alina shook her head, wondering if she was dreaming.
What are you talking about?
What about the guards? When they come through to check passports, what will they do? Won't they arrest them?
What for? This is why I'm a genius. They'll tell them they need to leave Romania, that as soon as we get to the end of the line, they'll have to head home. I imagine they'll escort them to the airport and put them on the plane back to England. Whatever. They'll be forced to go home.
A genius. She laughed, and he looked hurt.
Why do you have to be such a bitch? You won't be complaining when you get your hands on the money.
Feeling a little contrite, she said, I'm sorry. He harumphed.
Good. I'm starving. The buffet car will be open now. I'm going to get something to eat. Maybe while I'm gone you can think about why you have to be such a bitch to me.
She watched him stomp off through the carriage, in the opposite direction to the sleeper carriages, contrition turning to anger. She was sick of being called a bitch. Maybe she should put him in her comic book, one of Mirella's misogynistic victims. After Ion had been gone a few minutes, the door he'd left through opened and the border guards entered. They woke the few other people in the carriage and checked their passports. They spent a while talking in low voices to one passenger, who was outside of Alina's line of vision. She felt sweaty and tense. She didn't share Ion's confidence about what the guards would do when they discovered the English couple's passports were missing. What if they searched their bags? The plan would be over before it had begun, though she reminded herself there was nothing to link the drugs to her and Ion. Still, it would mean the loss of the money she was already counting on. She tried to relax, but when the guards got to her, she fumbled with her own passport, dropped it on the floor, making them snap at her to hurry up. For whatever reason, they were in a bad mood and highly alert, so much for them being semi-comatose. As she retrieved her passport, someone stepped past her, heading in the direction of the sleepers. She just caught a glimpse of a man's legs. Eventually, after asking her a dozen questions that made her sweat, the guards left the carriage and headed towards the sleepers.
Where was Ion?
Chatting up the girl in the buffet, no doubt. She got up, went to the other end of the carriage, and peered into the next one, but there was no sign of Ion. When she turned around, she saw the old man whose bag she'd carried walking towards her through the carriage, presumably on his way back from the toilets, which were located just before the sleepers. She smiled at him and waited for him to take his seat, then went towards the sleepers and peered through the greasy glass. She could see the guards standing outside one of the compartments. Daniel and Laura's. Then a border guard broke away from the group and came rushing towards her through the door, almost knocking her over, and hurried away out the door at the far end of the carriage. She returned to her seat and waited, wishing Ion would come back. What if Ion was wrong about what the guards would do? What if they arrested the English couple and searched their bags? She had a sudden attack of conscience. She liked them. They seemed nice, harmless, a happy couple with a bright future, planning to have a baby and get married. If the guards found the drugs, Daniel and Laura's lives would be destroyed. And she thought selfishly, the money Ion had promised would vanish before she ever got her hands on it. The border guard came back through the carriage, the ticket inspector following. Holding the door open, she could hear raised voices, Daniel protesting. What should she do? The passports and tickets were here, in Ion's bag, and she could grab them. Tell Daniel and Laura they must have dropped them on the seat. If she could reason with the guards, persuade them that she had seen the English couple with their tickets and passports when the Hungarian guards came through, that they were innocent victims of theft, that they were foolish foreigners who didn't understand that they shouldn't be in the sleeper carriage, it was her best option. She slipped through the door and went to join the party. But it hadn't gone well, had it? That was the fucking understatement of the century. Treading her way into the forest, twigs cracking beneath her feet, her eye on a spot a few feet ahead where she could piss, she almost laughed. The guards had been hostile, called her a punk bitch, and she had got angry, lost her cool, called them fascist lapdogs. That had been it. The next thing she knew, they were being marched back to the carriage, Eon still AWOL, and the train was slowing to a halt, and then they were thrown off. Her phone was left behind, and she had no cash. She couldn't wait to get to a payphone, to call Eon, to tell him what a fucking idiot he was, and how this was all his fault. She unbuttoned her jeans and pushed them down. The jeans were so tight, it was impossible to squat without toppling backwards or getting urine on her clothes. This was ridiculous. She unlaced one boot and pulled it off, before pulling one leg out of her jeans. Okay, this would work. She was even more happy that no one was watching her. As she crouched, she thought about how, despite this hiccup, the situation could still be redeemed. The plan could still work. The cocaine was still in the backpacks, undiscovered. Daniel and Laura had no passports or access to money. They would have to go home. When they reached town, they would be able to hitchhike or sell that fancy camera to get some cash for train tickets. She would escort the English couple to Bucharest, encourage them to take a plane home, and let Camellia know their flight number. It would be Camellia's job to intercept the couple, enlisting one of her dodgy friends, a pair of muggers with knives. Daniel and Laura wouldn't put up much resistance. Yes, it would still work, and then she would have her share of the money. No harm done, apart from a truncated holiday for the English couple. She finished and stood, pulling up her knickers and slipping her leg back into her jeans. She reached out for her boot and heard a noise. Her heart paused. Was someone there? She peered into the darkness and heard more noises, a crunch, a rustle, something snapping. But before she could cry out, there was a hand over her mouth, and another on her throat, breath warm in her ear, and a voice whispering that if she struggled or tried to scream, she would die. Chapter 43. Where the fuck was Alina? Back home in Sibiu, Eon couldn't do anything, couldn't eat, couldn't shit, couldn't sleep, without this question flashing in neon lights inside his head. It had been more than 2 days now since he saw her standing on the train platform, a figure that grew smaller and smaller as the train gathered pace. The two Brits stood beside her, their backpacks beside them on the ground. He focused on the bags, a knot growing in his stomach as the precious drugs, all that money in powdered form, vanished into the distance. But, he had thought, sitting down before he attracted the attention of the guards, it would be fine. Alina was there. She would ensure the plan went ahead, that Daniel and Laura got on a plane home. Maybe it would take a while for them to get to Bucharest and onto a plane, if none of them had any money. But Alina was smart. Eon knew, despite his constant references to his own genius, that she was cleverer than him. He wished he'd been chucked off the train too, or had seen what was going on in time to jump off after them. But he'd been too busy chatting with a pretty girl in the buffet car. Still, at least the Brits hadn't been thrown off on their own. Left to their own devices, they'd probably wander into the forest and be eaten by bears. So Eon waited. He was tired out by all the excitement, and slept a lot, like his pet cat. He made sure his phone was charged and beside him at all times. Needing to score some weed, he sold the British girl Samson, and spent a happy few hours indulging his herbal side. He watched a lot of porn on his old computer, and he waited for Alina to call or knock on the door, but she didn't do either. So where the fuck was she? Chapter 44. Alina woke up and instinctively tried to roll over, but her legs wouldn't move. Every morning started the same way. She would try again to move her legs and then jerk awake, remembering that her ankles were chained to the bed. And then, with daylight creeping through the narrow gaps between the wooden boards that covered the windows, all the other memories, the horror of her situation, would come rushing back. When she got over the daily shock, she always sat up. She was able to do that and peer towards the cot, checking that little Luca was okay, waiting for the monster to come and take him from his crib and hand the baby to her. And she would cuddle him and kiss his head, that soft, fragile patch beneath his downy hair, and even when he cried she didn't mind. Despite everything, all the things the monster did to her, the terrible fear that her fate would be the same as Luca's mother. While she had the baby to look after, she could endure. She heard movement on the stairs and braced herself. Sometimes he would bring her breakfast, bread rolls, water, meat, animals he'd trapped in the forest, she assumed. He would inspect the room, wandering about while she ate, browsing the display of Polaroid pictures on the wall like a visitor to a ghastly exhibition. That first night, there had been a little coffin over there, but that was long gone. The monster was shorter than her, like Eon, with a beak-like nose and stringy hair the colour of a sewer rat. The top of his head was bald and pocked with scars. He had the pallor of a man who never sees sunlight, and his skin was always coated with grime. His teeth were yellow and gappy, and his tongue was covered with a white layer. Other times he would come in, ignore her, and hand her lucre along with a bottle of milk before leaving the room. He would unchain her and lock the door, leave her to roam the room to play with lucre. She tried not to look at the Polaroids, the babies, and the women who had died here. She knew that Luca's photo was there, but hers hadn't been added yet, even though the monster had flashed the camera in her face one morning. Perhaps he wouldn't add her to the wall until she was dead. Maybe that was how it worked. The monster always left food for Luca, baby food in jars, along with shampoo and creams and nappies. He instructed her to ensure the baby was fed, clean, in good health. She realized very quickly that this was her role, an enslaved nanny. And this wouldn't have been so bad, terrible, but not the worst fate in the world, if it wasn't for the other role she had to play. Because on the worst mornings, once or twice a week, he would pull the covers off her, tie her wrists to the rusting bedposts, and, after squirting some kind of lube onto himself, he would climb on top and push himself into her. She would close her eyes and tried not to inhale his stinking breath, the stench of body odour that came off him. After he came and hoisted himself off her, she would be desperate to wash in the basin in the corner of the room, to use a little of the baby soap on herself. But he wouldn't let her. Instead, every time, he lifted her bottom and pushed a cushion beneath her, elevating her, so his semen remained inside her. He always left her like that for an hour, naked and exposed, hands and feet chained to the bed, before returning and untying her. Sometimes flies would land on her body, crawling about on her skin, and she would buck and thrash, unable to shift them, as they sipped at her flesh. Every time, she would lie and sob for hours, clutching little Luca to her, praying to God that the monster's seed would not find fertile ground, that her body would reject it. Chapter 45. Eon stepped off the bus, wrapping his coat around him, looked up and down the street at the prefabricated buildings, the grim-faced women pushing prams, the cars with ancient license plates. He'd looked it up online. Braver used to be a prosperous gold-mining town, and there was even a museum of gold here. He laughed humorlessly at the thought of tourists visiting this place. Ha! He bet Daniel and Laura didn't have this ghost town on their fancy itinerary. After a few days had passed, and Alina still hadn't called, Eon began to get really worried. He called Camelia in London, and asked her to check if Daniel and Laura were home. Rather bad-temperedly, she had agreed, and called back to report that there were lights on in their flat, that she had seen people moving around inside. She hung about until someone matching Daniel's description came outside to put some trash out. So they had gone home. "I'll post you the keys," Eon said to Camelia, "and you go inside, check their backpacks. They must have found the stuff by now." He was paranoid about mentioning the drugs on the phone. "Can you check the English news? Any reports of tourists finding them? Stuff in their backpacks?" Camelia had laughed in a way that made his balls crawl up into his body.
"Eon, I can't believe you."
"What? Why?"
"You really think your girlfriend," the word dripped with contempt, "would have followed your original plan? What would you do if you were her? You'd take the stuff and vanish, sell it, and keep all the money yourself."
"I wouldn't."
"Well, I would. And that's exactly what Alina would do. She'd take the money and use it to buy pens and pads so she could work on her stupid comic books. I bet you £1,000. Shit, I've been living here too long. That's what she's done.
She wouldn't risk the English couple taking it through customs, which, let's face it, was a ludicrous idea. Probably the worst you've ever had. And that's saying something.
Hey, it was genius.
Camellia laughed at that for a while. He amazed himself. Even when she was mocking him, he found it impossible not to picture Camellia's lovely breasts, which she showed him once in exchange for an eighth of weed.
Face it, Eon, the drugs...
What? Who is this?
This stuff is long gone. Your punk princess has taken it, and you'll never see her again. And after you promised me a share of that money, I'm stuck here pole dancing for limp-dick perverts. Thanks a lot.
She hung up. The more he thought about it, the more he realized Camellia was right.
Hell, Alina had probably planned to get herself, Daniel and Laura kicked off the train, cause a big fight with the guards, make them so angry that they would feel compelled to stop and eject her and the Brits. Then she would sneak the stuff, the coke, it was safe, he reminded himself, if it was only in his head, out of their backpacks, and find someone to buy it. Furious, he went into the bedroom where Alina had left some of her artwork, the comic book she'd been working on for months, and tore it into shreds. He didn't feel any better, so he punched the wall, but that hurt like hell. He yelled, making the cat shoot out of the room, and then looked around at the dump where he lived. He needed that money. He'd planned everything he was going to buy, the new TV, the gaming chair, the bearskin rug. He had been robbed. She wasn't going to get away with it. He found a small, cheap room in a Brava hotel that smelled of cabbage, and cabbage-induced farts, and threw his bag down on the bed. He felt like a bounty hunter, retracing Alina's steps. He had already been to the station where Alina and the Brits had been kicked off the train. It was a spooky place, not a soul in sight, unless you counted the little pack of dogs that were hanging around. One of them growled at him, and he chucked a stone at it, making it yelp and run away. He spotted a map pinned up inside the abandoned waiting room, and kicked in the door so he could go inside and take a proper look. Where would they have gone from here? He wandered out to look at the abandoned village, the quiet road. It was possible they'd hitched a lift, but how much traffic would there be in the middle of the night? None. Surely they would have headed towards the nearest town, Brava. He imagined them sitting here waiting for first light, then walking into town along the road. That's what he would have done. So here he was, having trekked through the forest, lovely in the morning light. Alina had been here. He could sense it. He had a photograph of her, and he took it around town, going into bars and shops, asking if anyone remembered her. No one did. They all looked at the photograph with blank eyes. The young people asked him what it was like in the big city, and he told them about the great riches there, how it was a place where dreams came true. He took a local girl with haunted eyes back to his fart-stinking room and showed her his genius beneath the sheets, until the guy in the next room banged on the wall. The next night there was another girl, and the night after that there were two. He had intended to stay in town for a few days, until he either found some useful information about Alina or failed. He ended up staying for over a month. Back home he was a nobody, an ant in the colony. Here, though, as the exotic stranger, the man from the big city, he was somebody, and he liked it. Maybe he could stay here forever, sleep his way through all the girls in town, although that was risky. He'd already had to hide out for a few days after the boyfriend of one of the girls he'd slept with found out about them and came looking for the out-of-towner. Despite his pumped body, Eon was a yellow-bellied chicken when it came to violence. It was one of the reasons the gangs back home wouldn't let him join. And on top of the danger from jealous boyfriends, he was running out of money, and there were no jobs here, even if he wanted one. He needed the money he would get from selling the cocaine, and if Alina had already sold the coke and spent the cash, he would make do with revenge. But he had no way of finding her, no leads, until he met the policeman. Chapter 46 Alina had been here for 49 days now. She had counted the sunsets. A couple of times she'd panicked, sure she'd forgotten the number, but then it had come back to her. Little Luca was almost crawling now, rolling over and smiling at her. He was going to be a big, strong boy. She felt pride swell in her belly.
Her period had arrived yesterday. When the monster saw the blood, he hit her, punching her again when she laughed and mocked him, told him she would rather die than bear his child. She watched Luca playing with the wooden rattle the monster had left in the cot, and wondered what Eon was doing right now. What had he done after he got off the train? Was he waiting for her to call him? Had he worried when she didn't get in touch? Did he care? She knew he wouldn't have reported her absence to the police because of the cocaine. He would be too scared of questions. But what about the plan? What did the English couple do next? Did they carry the drugs unwittingly to England? Did Camellia rob them as planned? She could picture Camellia and Eon now, having decided to split the proceeds in two, pleased that she had vanished. When the monster raped her, she conjured up pictures of her former boyfriend, and the hate consumed her, created a force field that protected her from the reality of what was happening. It had been his stupid fucking idea, his fucking stupid fault. She lay in her bed and imagined hurting him, a red rage enveloping her, and her fantasies flickered between smashing the monster's face with a brick and smashing Eon's face, until the two became interchangeable. When the monster hit her, it was as if Eon had hit her. When the monster parted her legs, she remembered how Eon had done the same, and she regretted every second she had given to him. And what about Daniel and Laura? At first she had been convinced they would seek help, go to the police. They had come here to look for her, had escaped, thanks to her, and she was sure they would send people to rescue her. That night, the monster had shot the two women in this room, replacing them with her. She had watched as he dragged the bodies from the room. On her first full day here, chained to the bed, trying to be brave, to be defiant, she had heard voices downstairs, and she was convinced the police must be here, asking questions. She screamed until her throat felt like it was bleeding. But no one came, not for hours. And then it was just him, the monster. And that was the first time he'd beaten her, little Luca watching from between the bars of his cot. That night she had woken and sensed someone standing over her, two people, she was sure. But she felt too groggy from the beating to focus, and she soon slipped back into unconsciousness. For days after that she waited, but still no one came. And with every day that passed, her hatred of the English couple grew. The light between the window boards told her the sun had been up for a couple of hours, but the monster hadn't come to see her yet. Luca was crying, hungry, reaching out for her from his cot. Her chest ached, seeing him like that, but at the same time she allowed hope to flare. Maybe the monster had gone away, or was dead. Okay, so her ankles were chained to this bed, but if she had enough time, she was sure she could free herself. But then the door opened. And, as always, she braced herself. Would he discover that her period had started? Beside her, Luca whimpered as someone came into the room and switched the light on. It wasn't the monster. This man was older, with a bald head. Despite his age, he looked fit, with broad shoulders and a body with more muscle than fat. She recognized him, but her head was so muddled she couldn't remember where from. She began babbling immediately. "You have to help me. I'm being kept prisoner here. A man kidnapped me. Are you the police? Oh, God, please, God, have you come to save me?" He ignored her, walking over to the cot and lifting the baby, stroking his head and making little noises to comfort him. Luca was a good boy, and he soon fell quiet. The man turned him this way and that, inspecting him. Finally he nodded and put him back in the cot, handed him a bottle of milk and watched as the baby lay drinking it. He turned to her. He appeared to be amused. Where did she know him from? She thought she had it, but the knowledge slipped away. He sat down on the edge of the bed and stroked her face. He spoke to her in their native language. "You've done a good job, looking after the little baby. Well done." He patted her hand. "Luca," she whispered. "You gave him a name." He smiled. "I like it. But he'll have a new one soon." She blinked at him. She was so weak, hungry, sucked dry of life and energy. She was filthy and needed a hot bath and tampons and clean clothes. Tears crawled through the dirt on her cheeks.
Are you here to save me? She asked.
He stroked her face again, brushing away a teardrop, then squinting disapprovingly at the grey smudge on his thumb.
I'm afraid not, he said. Not you. Not now. I'm here to take little Luca.
She jerked upwards, trying to push herself up onto her elbows.
No!
The man shushed her.
Don't worry about him.
He laid a hand on her bare belly. His palm was ice cold.
Soon, if all goes well, you'll have a baby of your own to look after.
He stood up, the mattress creaking, and walked back over to the cot, bent to lift Luca, who had drained the bottle, foamy milk streaking the plastic. The man walked towards the door. Alina cried out,
Please, no! Don't take him! He's mine! He's my baby, Luca!
The man stopped, tipping his head to examine her tear-streaked face. The way he looked at her reminded Alina of a farmer appraising livestock. For a single wonderful moment she thought he would change his mind, let her keep the baby. Instead he lifted Luca's little chubby arm and made the baby wave.
"Bye-bye, Mama,"
the old man said in a shrill voice. As Alina sobbed, the old man laughed and carried the baby out of the room. She heard his heavy footsteps thumping down the steps. Several days passed. She couldn't sleep without the soft, snuffling sounds the baby made. She cried as if she was his real mother. When she wasn't thinking about Luca, she tried to remember where she'd seen the old man who'd taken the baby away. But the inside of her head was so cloudy that every time she thought she had the answer, it slipped away. Shortly after dawn on the third morning without Luca, she heard a knocking sound from below. Somebody was at the front door. She wanted to cry out, but was afraid of incurring the monster's wrath. She stayed silent and could make out men's voices coming from below, three of them, she was sure. That made sense. The monster, the old man, and the newcomer. They talked for a while, and then she heard footfalls on the stairs. At least two people coming up. She braced herself, pulling the wretched blanket over her body. The old man came in first, switching the light on, followed by a fat man in a policeman's uniform. For a moment, hope surged inside her.
"She's pretty," the fat policeman said.
He stepped closer to the bed. He had large hands and broken veins on his nose. A drunk. Alina's father used to have veins like that.
"Isn't she?" said the old man. "One of the best we've had."
He pulled the blanket off her.
"Alina, take off your gown."
She shook her head.
"Do it,"
he snapped, raising a fist. The policeman watched, wearing an inscrutable expression. Arms shaking, she pulled the gown up over her head, exposing her naked body. It was freezing in the room, and she hugged herself, shivering.
"You want to go with her?" asked the old man.
"No, it's okay. A little early in the day for me."
The policeman chuckled.
"These days, I mainly like to look."
Too fat and weak to get it up, Alina thought. The old man nodded in an understanding way.
"Well, now that you've seen, we can go downstairs, where it's warm."
"Oh, must we?"
the policeman said, his dead eyes still touring Alina's body.
"We can chat here, yes?"
The old man laughed and waved a hand.
"Oh, yes. You're not going to tell anyone, are you, Alina?"
He laughed again.
"Take your arms away from your chest, girl. Show us what you've got. That's it."
The policeman made a low sound as though suckling the breasts his eyes were feasting upon. The old man went to the door and bellowed down the stairs.
"Dregos! Bring us a bottle of vodka and two glasses. Not too early for that, I trust, Konstantin." "Oh, no, never too early."
The monster appeared, so his name was Dregos, with the drink and glasses, like a butler in a black-and-white horror movie. He fetched two chairs, too, and after Dregos had left the room, the two other men sat down, adjusting their chairs to maintain a good view of her, and opened the bottle.
"How's business?"
Konstantin asked, without moving his eyes from her. Good God, was he going to jerk off right here and now?
"Oh, not bad. Just did an excellent deal.
but I could do with some fresh stock. I'll let you know if anyone suitable crosses my path, said Konstantin. Yes, the demand for high-quality product is stronger than ever, especially among the Russians. But right now you only have this one sow.
The old man nodded, and Alina blinked. The policeman really had used the word for a female pig. She fought back the urge to spit at him. If she could free herself from these manacles, get her hands on a weapon. She zoned out, entertaining herself with bloody visions of what she could do to him with a sharpened stick and a small knife. I liked her look. She'd pluck out his fucking eyes. No need to cut off his limp dick.
So, tell me what's happening in town, the old man said. That's what you came here to talk to me about, yes?
Konstantin nodded towards Alina.
A young man has been going around Breva, looking for this one, asking questions. Really? What does he look like? Gym body, about 5'7" or 5'8", in his 20s.
Eon. Oh, God, he was looking for her. He hadn't given up. She tried to keep her face neutral, but the old man was grinning at her.
That sounds like her boyfriend from the train. How sweet. He's come to try to find her, to save her.
The policeman glanced at Alina, who was still trying to keep her face from betraying her emotions. She didn't feel completely alone anymore. Eon actually cared about her. In an instant she felt stronger.
But don't worry, I have dealt with the situation. I have sent him off, searching for oranges.
Alina swallowed. This was an expression often used by the older generation, dating from the time when the fruit was impossible to find in the country's shops.
Good, said the old man. What about an English couple? Any British visitors to Breva?
The old man stooped to pick up the vodka bottle as he said this, so he didn't see the look that crossed Konstantin's face as he said,
No, why do you ask?
Sitting upright again now, refreshing his glass, the old man replied,
Oh, just something I heard about.
Konstantin shook his head and smiled.
We don't get many visitors from England in Breva. Some steam train enthusiasts a while back, maybe one or two visitors to the Gold Museum. Oh, and the guy who was obsessed with werewolves. Okay, well, that's good.
After the men left, drunk and slapping each other on the back, Konstantin casting a final greedy but impotent look at her body, Alina pulled the dirty gown over her head and stretched out her arm for the blanket. She couldn't reach it. She wrapped her arms around herself, shivering. Why had the policeman lied about Daniel and Laura? She had seen his expression. He had definitely encountered them. Had they tried to report what they'd seen? She could imagine them talking to Konstantin, him promising to look into it, the naive Brits trusting this corrupt policeman. Perhaps they thought they had done enough. She clenched her fists, digging her nails into her palms. Pathetic. Because she was still here. They were home, safe and well, and she had no doubt she was going to die here. The sow, slaughtered in an abattoir.
Chapter 47
Eon sat on his bed back at home in Sibiu. The first thing he'd done when he returned, exhausted and dispirited, was call for his cat outside. But after 2 months, the creature had no doubt found someone else to feed it. After meeting the helpful policeman, Konstantin, he had gone to Bucharest to look for Alina. According to the cop, Alina had been in Breva shortly after the incident on the train. The cop, who seemed much nicer than the bastards back home, went and spoke to the guy in the ticket office at the station, who remembered selling a ticket to Bucharest to a girl matching Alina's description. So Eon had gone to Bucharest. By this point, 7 weeks had passed. Progress in the city was slow. He trudged around bars and seedy nightclubs, showing Alina's photograph to clubgoers and doormen. A week in, a heroin addict Eon met in a hostel said he was sure he had seen this girl dealing drugs. He wasn't sure what exactly, at a club called Sapphire, in a district called Dristor. Eon wasted another week hanging out at this sleazy place, but there was no sign of her, and no one else had seen her. Eon realized the heroin addict had been lying. Then something really shitty happened. He attracted the attention of a group of local gangsters who wanted to know what he was doing if he was trying to muscle in on their turf. They beat him up, put him in hospital for 2 weeks. As soon as he felt better, when he no longer needed painkillers every 4 hours, he came home. Shattered and sick of the fruitless search, he spent the last of his money on a bag of industrial-strength skunk and holed up with his Xbox. He could have stayed like that until hunger forced him out to find a job to get on with life. And then Camellia had called him. "So," she said, "did you find her?" He groaned into the phone. "No. She's vanished from the face of the earth. A policeman in Brava."
"Where?"
"It's this shithole in Transylvania. He told me that he'd seen her, that she went to Bucharest, but I might as well have been searching for a virgin on—" He named the housing estate where he and Camellia had grown up.
"Fuck."
She sighed, then switched into a tone of voice he knew well, the sweet, seductive Camellia.
"Can I ask you a favour? Can you lend me some money?"
He roared with laughter. "I'm skinned, Camellia. I have no money. An eviction notice came yesterday. I'm going to have to get a job. Luckily, I know a lot of dealers, but—" She cut him off.
"I've got some money issues myself," she said. "You know I owe a lot of money to the guys who helped me get over here. I've been paying them off by working at the club. Now they're saying they want their money back faster. They want me to go on the game."
"Right."
"To become a prostitute, Eon."
"That's bad?"
"Fuck you," she spat.
She sounded like she was on the verge of tears. He waited while she gathered herself.
"So, have you found any evidence that Alina sold this stuff? Or that she's been trying to sell it?"
"No, none."
"Shit, maybe I was wrong. Perhaps the English couple did bring it back here after all."
"But you said—"
"Yes," she snapped, "I know what I said. I thought that was the most likely explanation. Hello, are you still there?"
"Yes. I'm just wondering, if Alina didn't take the stuff, what's happened to her? Where is she?"
"I don't fucking know, but I bet our English friends do. I thought you'd be able to find Alina, that she'd leave a trail like some kind of punk slug. But now, the Brits are all we have. Our last chance of getting that money, do you agree?"
Eon nodded.
"Well?"
"Sorry, I was nodding, yes."
She made an exasperated sound. "I'm desperate, Eon. If I can't get my hands on some cash quickly, I'm going to have to run."
Now she began to cry, a sound Eon couldn't bear.
"I don't know what I'm going to do."
"Come on, calm down."
"You've got the keys to their place, haven't you? Send them to me. When they're out, I'll go and take a look around. Even if I don't find this stuff, they must have loads of things I could sell. The guy looks like the type who'd have a top-of-the-range computer. She's probably got jewelry. There might be cash lying around. Please, Eon."
He agreed to call her back, then looked around the room at the filthy carpet, the crappy furniture, the eviction notice lying face down on the side table. He thought about how he was going to have to start selling drugs for some jerk who would treat him like a slave. But could he scrape together the fare to England? Maybe if he went by train. It would take a lot longer, but if he sold his Xbox, the remainder of the weed, went to visit his aunt, and helped himself to some of her jewellery. He cursed the idea that he'd wasted the past 3 months. But Camellia was right. The Brits must know something. He went online and searched English news reports. There was nothing about a British pair returning from Europe and handing in a haul of cocaine, and he was sure that would have made the news. He knew they hadn't been arrested at customs. That meant there was still a chance they had the cocaine, or, if they'd sold it, the money. It was better than sitting around here doing nothing. And at the end of it, there was a chance he'd be rich. He'd always wanted to see England, too. "Hold off," he said, when he called Camellia. "I'm coming over. You're knight in shining armour." Chapter 48. Today was the day she was going to do it. Put an end to it. She giggled at the thought of his face when he came into the room and found her lying in a puddle of her own blood. What would he do? Would he cry? The notion made her giggle again, the laughter bubbling through her like water surging through an unblocked pipe. For months, laughter had seemed like something she would never experience again. like beer and pizza and soft sheets and shopping and bus rides and hair dye and friends and beaches and TV and books and music and cuddles and happiness. But now she'd started, she couldn't